This is a recording of an oral history interview recorded with Giovanni Rebuli on the 21st of September 2018 at Bigolino in the province of Treviso in Italy. My name is Madeline Regan and I'm recording this for the Italian Market Gardeners Oral History Project. Thank you very much, Gianni, for agreeing to be interviewed today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for coming.
So we'll start with your family background. What is your full name?
My name is Giovanni Rebuli.
And your date of birth?
17th of March 1948.
And where were you born?
I was born in Val d'Obbiadene. There used to be a hospital in Val d'Obbiadene. I was born in the hospital of Val d'Obbiadene. That is the municipality where you find the suburb of Bigolino.
Great. And were you named for anyone in your family?
Yes, I think so, because both of my grandfathers on mum's side and on dad's side were both called Giovanni.
So it was like without exception that you were
going... Without exception. They did not argue.
And where were your parents living when you were born?
That's a good question. I think they were living in a rented house in the centre of Bigolino, okay. Near the Bigolino Square.
Right. Mm-hmm. And could you please tell me the full names of your parents and their date of their place of birth?
Right. Well, Mum's name was Amabile Dal Toa. She was born on the 7th of June 1924. And Dad's name was Teodoro Rebuli. He was born on the 27th of January 1920.
And were they both born in Bigolino?
They were both born in Val d'Obbiadene.
Oh, okay. And in your mother's family, how many brothers and sisters did she have?
Our mum used to have, she had, two brothers and one sister.
Right.
Plus herself. So there were two brothers and two sisters. Then my grandfather on mum's side married a second time because his wife died when the kids were quite young. And he had another two children. So mum also has a stepbrother and a stepsister.
And your father?
My father has had two sisters and a brother. So total four, two sisters and two girls and two boys.
And did any of those aunts and uncles go to Australia?
On mum's side, no. On my father's side, yes, my father's brother, Enrichetto, in Italian, Enrico, went to Australia, I think, in 1950 or 1951. And Ginevra, one of the sisters, went to Australia with Enrichetto, I think.
Right. And what do you know about how your parents met each other?
What do I know? That's a difficult question. I think they just... Mum was working in a very, very large family, traditional patriarchal family. The great-grandfather used to run the family, and he used to have brothers and... sisters and in-laws and whatever. It was a very large family. So they used to have work a lot of land. It would have been something like 60 acres. It wasn't their land. It was what do you call piecework?
Was this part of the Mezzadria?
This was the Mezzadria, yes. They were pretty well off. I think Mum and Dad just met casually, you know, going to church on a Sunday. And that was it.
And when did they marry?
Oh, for heaven's sake. They married... I'm not sure if they married when Bruno, when Enrichetto's son was born. I think on the 15th of February 1947.
And they married here?
Yes, they married here.
And what you've said what work your mother did prior to getting married. Was she what kind of work
was
she doing?
Well, she was farm work, basically. She was a little girl. She grew up as in the family, the big family. This area here was basically an area dedicated to agriculture. Today it's become the center of world Prosecco wine production in the world, but then there was very little wine production. It was always Prosecco, but wasn't known at all. And they used to have pigs, cows, pigs for the meat, cows for the milk, vegetable plots, hay. They were self-sufficient in this way, in maintenance.
And your father's work?
My father's work was, as a kid, he worked the land with my grandfather. My grandfather lost his wife. His wife died when the four kids were very, very young. And he worked land, his own piece of land in Vigolino, where he grew wine. He had cattle like everyone. He had a pig or two or three pigs, whatever it was. And I think the kids just grew up in this agricultural setting, helping out. They went to school, but schooling then was not, obligatory. As it is today, I think Dad did his fourth or fifth grade elementary school. Mum, I think, succeeded in getting through a fourth. That was it. That was all their schooling, all the schooling they had. This was the majority of the people that lived here. Let's say the poor people, because this area was immensely poor.
And going back to the mezzadria system, mm-hmm. Could you explain that?
The landowners used to be quite wealthy. They used to own all the lands, let's say.
And this was like historic?
This was historic, yes. This was historic and quite wealthy. And the farmers, then they would rent, they couldn't work the lands themselves. They didn't have the necessary tools or the will or whatever it was to work the lands. And so they paid... these farmers, people with their own families, to live on the land and to work the land for them. And they would go, I believe, mezzadria means half. So they would split the profits, or if we want to call them that way, at the end of the year. That's how it worked.
And your father's family wasn't part of the mezzadria?
My father's... My grandfather on Dad's side owned some land. I don't know exactly how much he owned, which he lost when he was young because he signed some papers for a friend of his who needed money. And it was the bank mortgaged his house, my grandfather's house, as he was helping a friend out. And the friend went bankrupt and my father lost his land. So my grandfather went through hell raising four kids because he lost his land.
So how did he manage? And
working for, working as a mezzadro for, other people who owned land, working on their land and going halves on whatever he produced. My grandfather on that side never remarried. So he grew up, he'd lost his wealth, let's say, the house he owned and the lands he owned. He worked the rest of his life working as a mezzadro, going halves on whatever he produced and raising the family. So I think you can imagine how the kids were forced. My grandfather was an excellent, he was a very kind man. But the kids were forced quite young to work and to help him out.
Difficult life.
Very difficult life. But in general, this is the life that you'll find the majority of the people did live in this area. Not the, the better-off people, but the better-off people were not many, very, very few.
So if you were to describe this area of Vigolino mm-hmm. At the time, that you were born, mm-hmm. what would you say?
Well, I'm just speaking of what I've been told. on, you know, memories of mum and dad and, you know, my uncles and people. It was a bit of a happy time for them because they were young. But they just come out of a bitter war, with a lot of people having died, a lot of suffering, a lot of anguish, physical suffering, mental suffering, and I think the thing that, you know, clings to my mind is the poverty. There was no dreaming then. There was no possibility to dream. They just had to work and help the family in whatever there was needed. So as a kid, I just remember poverty here. People were forced. My father went to Germany at the age of 16 to work in gypsum mines in Leonberg, which is north of Stuttgart in Germany. He worked there nearly 4 years at the age of 16. I remember he left and he didn't have a pair of shoes, normal shoes. His father gave him a pair of his own shoes to go to Germany, which just goes to indicate how poor the area was, or how poor the family was. Mum's side was a little better off.
And why was that?
Well, because they worked so much land, because my great-grandfather on Mum's side evidently was a bit of a merchant. He used to contraband, I've been told, tobacco and some other stuff. This is between the First and Second World Wars. He was quite a clever bugger, they'd say.
So in comparison...
They were pretty well off. But once again, being well off, they had to look after not one family. There were many families in the... within that, you know, under my great-grandfather's, say, domain.
And we're living all in
All in the one room. It was a very big building, very big building.
So there would have been more than four families?
More than four families, yes, four, maybe five.
And
with the kids.
Yeah, and the number of kids growing.
Yep. So the women would, you know, help out in the, in the gardens outside, in agriculture, whatever they were planting. And then some of them had to dedicate time to cooking from morning till night. And everything was rationed. I remember this, you know, they used to ration everything. You wouldn't have two slices of salami, you'd have one slice of salami. That was it.
So
they were very hard times.
The economy of this area then
was agriculture.
And
there were, I think there was some philander. They used to spin silk here. They used to have silkworm farms, and they used to spill silk. They used to make silk. That was very, very important. But all of this area here.
And who would have owned those philander?
Oh, I don't know the names.
People from the area?
Oh, perhaps from the area, from Milano or from outside, from, you know, bigger cities, definitely.
And was that seasonal work?
No, it was, it must be seasonal because I imagine it would be, because the trees to feed the silkworms, you know, they only bloom, or they only have that opportunity once a year, I think. I don't know how it works, I don't know the timing.
But they were mulberry trees, usually.
The trees that we see outside, we call them morar in dialect. It's giglio.
Okay. And in
so there were a couple of, two or three of the there were quite a few silk growing farms for the silkworm, and silk mills, there were quite a few silk mills. I don't know exactly how many, but there were quite a few.
And was that seen as women's work or men's work as well?
Basically women's, but there were always also men doing it.
And in families, from what I understand you're saying, that it was not an agricultural life where they were selling what they grew.
No, they were producing. They were producing and... evidently, they were also selling, but I won't go into that because I don't know enough about it. They probably would sell because I remember Mum telling me that, you know, when she was a little bit bigger, she would go to the marketplace in Val d'Aubiardene. There would be the weekly market on the Monday, I think it was held. And she would sell some wares. I don't know what she was selling. But she would go and sell, you know, her grandfather or her father would go and say, go and sell these two. But as a little girl, so I imagine that they could have sold something. But it wasn't a real business. Their business was growing the produce.
Would they have had money?
Yes. My great-grandfather had, I've been told by Mum, he could have bought the 60 acres, nearly 60 acres. It was one piece of land. It's unique. It's a beautiful, I'll show you the scenery. It's not very far from here. And for the sum, but you know, it had money had a different value then. But he just missed out on arriving at the sum that was requested to buy it. He could have bought it all the same. He would have made a fortune for himself, but he didn't. That was his biggest mistake. He did make a mistake, but he did have the money to buy it, and he didn't.
I was wondering in other families, like, say, in your grandfather's family,
right,
whether there would have been money passing hands or was it subsistence?
Subsistence. Pure subsistence. I've never heard my father or my uncle, Riketo, or my aunties speak, of any type of abundance of money or, you know, wealth or subsistence. Full stop, you know, very, very poor, very, very dire, very derelict sort of an upbringing.
And what happened when young people married? What was the tradition that followed? Where did, like, you know, your mother married into the Rebuli family.
See?
So what happened then? She moved from her family.
What happened then? She would go and live with my father. I remember one thing. I won't go into detail because I don't know enough about it. But she would move into my father's house, or they would rent, not being sufficiently autonomous economically. Economically, they would rent a house or a room or whatever. But they went to live with my grandfather. My grandfather was renting a home, as I said, in Bigolino, near the Bigolino Square. So they went and lived with my grandfather.
And how many were there then? Like,
no, it wouldn't have been a big family because I don't know where Riketo was living. Perhaps he was living with them. Because my father, Riketo, were brothers, and my mother and Riketo's wife were sisters. They grew up together. They were the same age. So it would have been quite good for them. So from that side, you know, it would have been an excellent combination because they always got off very, very well. But I think they would have lived with, I think that all of them lived together with my grandfather. Yes.
And so it meant that there were additional people to be able to work and...
Yes, I know. You know, we're talking about my grandfather. My grandfather on Dad's side was not well off. You know, it was always just enough. And once again, there was not sufficient work for the men. They didn't have enough land to make any profit at all, to create a business, to create, even to plant agricultural products. They didn't have the land. So my father was at the age of 16. Well, he worked here doing odd jobs, my father, when he was a kid, after he left school, working for, you know, different farmers or working for different small artisans, getting paid nothing at all. And the same would have been for my uncle. The girls would be working for families as waitresses or maids. That was the lot that was set up for them. For a lot of people here, I'd like to say the majority. And this was, it was just a survival race.
And how common would it have been for young men like your father to go to
very
another
common.
Country
very
to work?
Common, very common.
And how did they know that there would be work there?
Oh, well, you know, someone started eventually, you know, evidently years before, because this area, the poverty of the area and the development of the area didn't start when my dad was born. You know, he found this. This area went through the First World War. The land was devastated. The houses were devastated. Everything was devastated. This was the centre of the First World War. This is where the First World War ended. This, geographically speaking, it was fought here. So we've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of dead. And, you know, there was nothing here. Many Italians from southern Italy, from the Veneto area and Friuli Venezia Giulia, emigrated from Italy. The majority of Italian immigrants come from south of Italy, centre-south Italy, and the Veneto and Friuli Venezia Giulia, which basically is the northeast of Italy. These were the poorest areas of Italy. So they started immigrating back in the 19th century, early 20th century. So by word of mouth, when they start, where would you go to begin with? You go to, you know, a country that were better off, such as Germany, although it was not thriving. You know, there would be more work there, better organized. They had iron mines to begin with. You know, Belgium had coal mines. France is a much bigger country than Italy. They had, you know, many, many more possibilities of finding labor in France. Italy is 300,000 square kilometers, okay? France is 600,000, to give you an idea. So when my parents, my uncle and my dad and other people went abroad, they went into other countries to work, like Germany, Switzerland, Belgium, France. They went there evidently because there was someone there before them that they knew from the same village, right? And by word of mouth, they say, you come here, we have a job for you, right? And so they left Italy and they went to work.
At a young age?
And that's
age?
Where they, at a very young age. Very young age. They were little boys.
Johnny, I'm thinking as you're talking, maybe we should explain the geographical context mm-hmm. of this region mm-hmm. Of the Veneto, and also where you are located in Bigolino, mm-hmm. Because of people listening.
Right. So just to describe, let's say to create an image of where we're living. This area was dominated by the Venetian Republic. The Venetian Republic was a nation state that existed autonomously without ever having been plundered for 1,100 years. It lost its independence when Napoleon came in, conquered it. Okay, it was, you know, towards the end of its history, its lifespan. And he eventually sold it off to the Austro-Hungarian Empire in order to facilitate his war ambitions in going to Russia. So Venice was a sea power. It wasn't a military power, it was a commercial sea power. It was so for many, many years, for hundreds and hundreds of years. So Venice is on the water, it's on the Adriatic Sea, it's on the plains. So we have what's called in Italy, La Pianura Padana. Pianura Padana extends from Piemonte, which is northwest of Italy, where we have the big city called Torino. And a plain begins to form from Torino, coming southeast. So there we have a plain. And in this plain, we have a lot of agriculture, okay? The majority of our agriculture is to be found in the Pianura Padana. Now that extends into Lombardia, southern part of Lombardia, and Emilia-Romagna plains. They have some hills, but we call it Pianura Padana. Venice is part of what is called the Pianura Padana. It's on flat ground. From Venice, going north, we come to a city of Treviso, which is 30 k's from Venice, okay? Treviso going north again, we come to Valdobbiadene, which is 30 kilometers, as I said, from Treviso. When you come to Valdobbiadene, you hit the Prealps. So we've come up from the plains, from the Pianura Padana, the top section of the Pianura Padana, and we meet the Prealps. Prealps are the mountains, the first mountains you hit before seeing the Alps. The Alps in northeast Italy are called the Dolomites, discovered because of the hue, their pinkish hue, by a French scientist called Monsieur Dolomite. And today they call the Dolomites because they change hue during the day and they're pinkish. Northwest, they're called the Alps, Italian Alps. The Italian Alps, they extend, so we're at the foothill of the Prealps. The mountain behind Bigolino, which is 2 km from Valdobbiadene, the municipality, the mountain behind Valdobbiadene is the highest peak. It's a round mountain, it's not a rocky mountain, is about 1,650 meters high, okay? To the left, we have across the river Piave, which flows down from the Dolomites to Venice, okay? It divides, let's say the valley, divides the what we call our mountain range, Pianezze, Cesene, Monte Cesene, Monte Barbaria, and this section goes out towards Vittorio Veneto. On the other side of the Piave, we have what is called the Monte Grappa, which is a mountain range that extends north and goes into the province of Belluno. And that the highest peak there, I think, is about 1,800 meters. So here we've got the first mountains, you see. Going south, plains everywhere. You go into Castelfranco, you go into Vicenza, you go into Padova, Verona, you've got plains. Mantova, you've got the plains. Milan, you've got the plains. So here we have the first mountains. Not many people realize that Italy does have Alps. And Italian Alps, they extend from the east, which means basically bordering with Slovenia, Austria, Switzerland, and France. So we have all the Alps. We have the French Alps, the Swiss Alps, the Austrian Alps, and the Slovenian Alps. Not many people know that.
So I'm thinking of people like your father in 1930-something going off to Germany.
36.
How would he have made that journey?
By train.
And of course the Alps, when you talked about the First World War, mm-hmm. were very important in terms of the feature of
defense, fighting. Definitely, if you visit the Alps, I'm going to take Rino, a friend of mine, with his wife. We're going to visit the Dolomites. You'll find the tunnels that were excavated in the Alps in the First World War. Just to understand the immensity, the fatigue, the ferociousness of the war, because they loaded their cannons onto mules, right? And they took the cannons, then they had to reassemble them on mule paths and took them to the peaks of the mountains to bombard the enemy. This is, you know, Italians and Austrians, it worked both ways. But the galleries that were built underground for protection, for storing the ammunition, for storing the foodstuffs, etc., to surround the enemy or whatever, it's something that's it's just awe-inspiring. You can't believe that, you know, a human being can suffer so much and work so hard with his bare hands, because there were no machines then.
Incredible.
Yes, and it is.
So in terms of the legacy of World War One, it would have been felt by your father's generation, your grandfather's generation, mm-hmm. very deeply.
Felt very deeply. They didn't speak of it. No one in the family spoke of war. No one, neither the First or the Second World War. They occasionally did speak of the First World War, occasionally. But no one ever openly spoke or took sides. This is from my family. But in general, people who fought in wars, they won't speak openly of wars. They won't offend the enemy, because they weren't an enemy at the end of the day, were they?
But the destruction nevertheless was...
Well, the destruction, you know, that subdued any, you know... Destruction, I think, kills any sign of hope, or... It makes you very sad. It makes your life very, very... It just puts out the light, I think. People who've lived through the wars and through poverty, can actually teach us a lot. And one thing I've learned is that, you know, people who have lived the life that way, they don't talk about it. They don't throw words around heedlessly. And when they speak, you know, they know what they're talking about. I think we should listen to them, you know, more carefully. Today it's the opposite. Today we know everything.
When you say that your parents didn't speak about World War II...
Well, they did speak about it, but it's not, you know, today... I'm trying to make a reference, you know, people, I live in an area where people, you know, speak about, you know, politics, and we need a strong hand, we need a strong government, we need a strong man, we need this, and look what Mussolini did, look what Hitler did, look what, you know, and I think that's sad, because when I grew up as a kid, my mother and father never said, they would say, okay, Mussolini did this, or, but they never, you know, overindulged, you know, because they lived what war meant. And I always say to my friends here, you know, one man alone won't solve any problems. Never. He can create a lot of problems.
Yeah.
That's why, so our parents and people who've lived the war won't speak of it willfully, because they've lived it on their, you know, on their skins. You don't talk about suffering, do you? You can, but, you know, killing people, atrocities, starvation, going without food, infection. They went through all of this, but not for 1 week, for many years. And then the aftermath of the war, because things don't happen miraculously. So you've got to get back and put things together.
Did your father serve in World War II?
Yes, he did.
And where did he serve?
He served on the Italian front and in Yugoslavia. Don't ask me where, but he did. He served in Yugoslavia.
And do you know the impact of World War II in this area?
In what sense? The physical impact?
Yeah.
Well, this area was destroyed, totally destroyed.
So it was destroyed in World War One.
Yes, destroyed in World War Two.
And again, because
as I said before, Monte Grappa is the seat of where the Italians set up, let's say, a blockade against the invasion from the Austro-Hungarian army that were coming down from Austria, that come down into Friuli, Venezia Giulia, right, and through Vittorio Veneto, and they were stopped here on the Piave, on the river Piave. There's a song that says the river Piave mormora murmurs. It's a sacred river. It's called Il fiume sacro alla patria. The nation's sacred river, because it was here that they stopped the invasion. They say that the Piave was flowing red with blood. It's not a myth. Now, I don't know exactly how. I know that when the Austrians retreated, they left 300,000 prisoners here. 300,000.
And was that World War One?
World War One. We're talking big numbers, aren't we?
And who were the prisoners?
Well, you know, Austrian, going back, well, prisoners are prisoners on both sides, it depends. But when the Austrians retreated, right, and declared defeat, returning back to their lands in 1918, the prisoners, they abandoned everything here. And as I said, you know, they were fighting in winter too. Winter in those years is not like winter today. Winter was, I won't say like Siberia, but, you know, we're pretty close to it. So they would have been Austrian prisoners.
And in World War II, this area would have been occupied by the Germans.
Definitely.
And did your parents ever talk about that kind of experience?
No. They wouldn't. You know, there would be the fascists, okay? Germans are Germans. Then there would be the fascists and the partisans. right? But my parents never, this willfully, they never took sides, because it's always, you know, there's always good and bad on both sides. If you look at, you know, life, you've got to, you always got to try and mediate and find. They never, they did speak of it, but never, they never went over the bend around, you know, too much.
So you wouldn't have known if people were treated badly here?
No, I do know. Some were treated. There were atrocities committed here.
By the fascists?
Amongst Italians, see.
And the partisans?
See, both.
Must have been hard after all of that happened for people to have a sense of what...
Of belonging here, you're right, of, you know, and of demanding... some were retaliating even back in the 70s.
In what kind of way?
Well, they were sending because someone, you know, during wars, someone gets rich all of a sudden, and we don't know where the money came from. Someone who's always been, you know, poor, all of a sudden he's filthy rich. Where did he steal his money? So, you know, there are some people who go and put their nose into it and start doing some research, and they find out that he stole the money from so-and-so, and or perhaps he killed someone. And I remember back in the early 70s, some of the culprits who become very rich, I think three or four, received coffins on their front door. I'm talking about 1970, 71.
And did anything happen?
No, nothing.
But
arose,
it was
no.
A warning?
Well, it was, yeah, it was a sign that we know all about it. We're talking about war.
And memory?
War's not a game. It's not like, you know, cowboys and Indians on TV.
you've given a really full and interesting account of, like, that historical context mm-hmm. in which your parents were living as young people.
You know, I don't know anything about it because, you know, just I'm living on memory now of what they told me. And I repeat, they did not speak of the war. The only thing I know is that, you know, you have a feeling for things of the poverty. That's what lingers.
And just finishing off about your family, did you have any siblings?
No.
So you were a precious only child?
I was only 2 years old, you know. I was 2 years old when I left Italy for Australia. I had two cousins, and they were like brothers and sisters. Bruno, Ricchetto's son, and Rosanna, his daughter. We're the same age, basically.
Mm-hmm. And you grew up together?
We grew up, yeah.
Yeah. Going to turn now to your parents and going to Australia. Mm-hmm. What do you know about the situation here in Bigolino at the time that your father went to Australia, which was
1949. There was no work. I'll just sum it up that way. There was little work here. There were little... there was no promise of improvement. They couldn't see anything developing to create opportunities for work, opportunities for, you know, in doing anything at all. So that's when a lot of the Italians from the Veneto area, well, in general from Italy, after the many Italians left Italy after the war because there were no prospettive. Nothing was developing.
So how did your father make the decision?
He made the decision because back in the, I think it was 26 or 27, my grandfather, my dad's father's brother, Brunone Reboli, went to Australia with his wife. I don't know if he went with her or if she arrived later, I can't remember, I don't know that. But he had relatives there, and they communicated, okay, but you know, 26 to 49, we're talking about 23 years, so it's a long time. Evidently there was communication, some form of communication, and people were leaving. So when people leave, people talk about it. And if there's no work here, and you see people leaving, and you're a young person, you know, this is my opportunity. I would think, that it's my opportunity also to leave and live my life better, hopefully.
It was obvious that it was going to be Adelaide because of the relatives.
Yes, it was Adelaide. It was either Melbourne or Adelaide. There were some, the Rossettos that went there, I think the majority stopped in Melbourne. But we landed in Adelaide because we had, let's say, my father's uncle Brunone was in Adelaide, and the Rossettos were in Adelaide, and some other people from Bigolino were in Adelaide. That's where we ended up.
And do you know if he travelled with anyone else?
No, that I don't know.
And did your father tell you anything about his early experience in Adelaide?
I think when he went to Adelaide, he worked in the market gardeners for some Italians who'd been there, who'd arrived in Australia in the 20s. This is to pay off because, you know, when he went there, he didn't travel first class or second class. He had to borrow money to travel. That gives you, you know, a further idea of how poor the area was. So when my parents went there, they went there on borrowed money, and they had to reimburse the money to the people who'd lent it to them.
And were they people here or in Australia?
They were people. That's a good question. I don't think it's influential. I think it may have been in Australia. It may have been through people here. Can you follow me? So when they got to Australia, I think my father and also my mum, because Dad went in 1949, we went in 1950. When he went there, having worked in mines, initially he worked to pay off some debts for the market gardeners.
And who did he work for, do you know?
I think perhaps the Burnos. I think, I'm not sure. And then he went to work for 6 months, I think he worked 6 months or 9 months, near Alice Springs in the mines, the mica mines in Alice Springs. Not in Catherine. I can't remember the name of the mining city. I think it's still there. Maybe it's closed down. Then he came back to Adelaide.
Where did he live when he first arrived?
I think he lived with my Zia Nana, Zia Giovanna. That's his uncle's, Brunone Reboli's wife, who was living on Frogmore Road, near the old wooden bridge. I think he lived there. That's where we actually, when my mum and myself arrived after, I think, about a year, that's where we went to live also.
And Brunone died early, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Was he alive at that time when you arrived?
No. No, I think he died. I won't know. I've got no idea. I think he died in the early 40s. Just thinking, because he wasn't there when we arrived.
And of course, his wife was a Rossetto.
Zia Giovanna, sì, Rossetto. She was a Rossetto.
So you went to a family where you had cousins.
Went to a family. Well, you know, my dad's first cousins. So Zia Giovanna. Had three children when she left Italy, Dorina, Vito, Elvio. And they were between, I think, 5 and 8 years old, or 5 and 9 years old when she left. I think she left in the 30s. Just thinking out loud, 24. I think in the 30s, early 30s. Then she had another child, nicest guy you can meet, Guido. In 1938.
So he was 10 years older than you?
He was 10 years older than me. But, you know, when we got there, it was, you know, it was a big, big family. When you're poor, when you don't have much at all, right, but there is work, you can work and you can pay your bills and you can pay for what you're eating, you're happy, which was completely different to what it was here. You were very happy because you were making ends meet, and you could see the possibility of creating something for yourself. So we lived with Zia Nana. She was a lovely lady, for 6 months. I can see it wasn't a house. It was a house, but it was a shed. Okay, it was a house, but it was a real shed. It had its own commodities. It was looked after. It was clean. But, you know, the space was limited. I remember we used to have curtains, you know, dividing one room from the other, the bedroom from the kitchen there. Anyway, when we left the house, my father found a bigger place on Torrens Road with an Australian gentleman. His name was Mr. Cook. I say Mr. because I've never known his Christian name. And everyone used to call him Mr. Cook. He was bald, quite an old man, good man. I always remember distinctly he used to love drinking tea with milk and butter, with a scoop of butter on the milk. Nice, isn't it? And we lived there, I think, for a couple of years. So that meant that my father, mum and myself, and then when Riketo came to Australia, Riketo never lived on Frogmore Road, was in Anna. He immediately lived in on Torrens Road with us at Mr. Cook's place. So both the families were there. So I grew up as a kid for a couple of years with Bruno, with my two little cousins. I was 3 years old. Okay.
And where was your father working at the time that you were on Torrens Road?
I think he was working at GM, General Motors, Woodville.
And did Riketo also get a job there?
Then Riketo got a job there too.
And then his wife and two children?
Yes. Go.
That they arrived also?
They arrived after. In 51, I think, or 52, I'm not sure, yes.
And so,
with my Zia Ginevra, with the older sister.
And was she married?
She wasn't married. She was not married. Which goes to show, you know, the immensity of the poverty there was here.
Nothing?
Nothing.
How old would she have been?
Oh, for heaven's sake, Zia Ginevra was, I think, she was 1916, born in 16. 1916 she was born.
So she was already...
1916 to, let's say, 50, we're talking about 34. She would have been 34, 36. Yeah.
And so did you all live with Mr. Cook?
I don't know anything about Zizi Never. I don't know where she went to live. She didn't live with us at Mr. Cook's. I remember Riketo's family lived, and my family lived together at Mr. Cook's place. It was a very big house. It was a lovely house, run down, evidently, because he was an old man, had no one to look after him. That's why he took us in. And Mum and Etty used to look after him.
Like cook for him?
Cook for him, you know, wash for him and whatever. He was a good man, Mr. Cook. We were there, for 2 years? But my Zia Ginevra, I don't know. Perhaps she went, I've got no idea where she lived.
And did your mother and your auntie Etty work outside the house as well?
Yes, we had a garden patch.
But also, did they have another paying job?
Mum worked at... Brazzales.
With the mica processing
business, where they put the mica into the irons. I don't know what else. That's Mum worked there for a few years. I don't know my Zia Etty if she worked somewhere. She had two small kids, or perhaps she looked after me and Mum did the working. Can you follow me? For a salary. Then quite quickly after Dad and Riketo started working at Holden's, both the women got a job at Holden's. They were all at Holden's.
Who would have looked after you three children then? Or maybe it was shifts.
You know, not when we were at Mr. Cook's, because we didn't live many years. I think we were at Mr. Cook's for 2 years, or 1.5 years, not many years. That would have been four and a half. That's when the men were working. They were making money. They had a salary. So that's when they decided to invest their first monies, and they bought a block of land in Glen Eagles.
Off
Grange Road. On Adria Avenue. I still remember the name, Avenue. And it was like, you know, it was sand everywhere. It was only sand there. I remember there used to be a church there, a Catholic church, on the Ongrange Road, on top of the mound. There used to be a huge dump on the right-hand side. No houses, there was nothing there. Well, there were there might have been two houses, I think. I'm exaggerating, but there was nothing there. So they bought two blocks off Grange Road on Adria Avenue, three blocks, sorry, one for my dad, one for Riquetto, and one for Piero Mattiasso, who had married Pierina Vittorello. They're both from Bigolino. And they came across to Australia more or less at the same time as my parents did and Riquetto did. And the idea was to build a house or a shed, do it up comfortably, do it up well, and help each other to build it to save money. You don't go to a contractor because you save your money, you do things yourself. So they built Dad's home, then they built Piero's home, and then when it was time to build Riquetto's home, they were doing overtime. They were working 8 days a week. So Riquetto's house never got built on that block. So he bought himself his own house. It was an old house, pretty run down, as they all were at that moment, on Aruna Road, 12 Aruna Road, Kilkenny, near West Croydon. So that's how things started to evolve.
So you have told me that you had some very clear first memories of time in Adelaide.
And as a kid, I had memories, you know, when I was small child. It's very rare that, you know, you can remember things when you were 2 years old, two and a half or three. I still remember certain. I have clear, vivid images of when I was living on Frogmore Road at my Zia Nana's place, you know, in the house itself, you know, jumping up and down on the bed, or seeing the, she used to make tomato paste, tomato sauce. And I remember her drying the tomatoes on pieces of cloth in the backyard under the sun. I remember the red color of the tomatoes. I remember playing games with her older daughter, Dorina. I used to pester Dorina. And she used to go, I was only 2.5 years old. These things I remember. I remember Vic used to have a utility car. I had these fingers chopped off when I was there, you see, by a guy who was sleeping on a sun deck chair. And someone played a dirty on me. I was only very, very small. But I remember these things. Then I remember also when we were staying at Mr. Cook's place on Torrens Road. I remember the gigantic, for me, you know, when you're a kid, everything's gigantic. You see things 10 times bigger than what they are actually. Bamboos, a lot of bamboos. I remember Mr. Cook quite well, being a nice man. Gentle, polite, and I remember his tea with the milk and with the butter.
And your mother and your auntie having a garden in his...
Well, they had a garden. They had a chicken farm there too. At the back, he had a big block, very big block. Blocks used to be big there.
And did they buy the chickens?
Well, evidently they bought them, or someone gave them to them. I've got no idea.
So after you left...
I remember going, when we shifted, I interrupt you. The reason why, I think it was about three and a half years old, four when we shifted. We left from, I don't know the name of the suburb on Torrens Road. I remember the chicken because my father caught the chicken and my mum put them in bags, potato bags. Threw them on the lorry. And we brought them to Gleneagles. So these are the things that I remember. I still have images of these things in my mind.
That's great that you do. at Gleneagles, do I understand that your father and your uncle and Piero Mattiazzo actually built the houses themselves?
Yes, they did.
So they must have had some skills.
They did. My uncle was very good at Riquetto. He was a good artisan. He could you know, work very well, do about nearly everything with his hands. He was good at he was a good carpenter, and the structure of the sheds was in wood, so they'd buy the wood, and my father would help, Pieter would help. You know, they were pretty good themselves, but the insight and the ability, the know-how was supplied by Nikita. That's how they built them.
And what was your house like on Airdrie Avenue?
I'd live there tomorrow. It was a shed made of tin. Well, what do you call it? You know,
corrugated iron.
Yeah, corrugated iron. Inside it had slabs of plaster or asbestos. I shouldn't say asbestos, but it was asbestos. Then it was allowed. Okay.
So that was like a lining?
It was a lining, all inside. There was, I don't know if there was any insulation. There may have been some insulation between the corrugated iron and the asbestos lining, okay. Then they'd drawn the electric wires for electricity. Initially, we didn't have electricity. There was no electricity there. There was no plumbing. Hold on, there may have been plumbing. I know there was no toilet. There was no sewage. When we got there, there was no sewage, and there were no electrical lines in that area.
What year?
52, 53. There may have been, but not... There may have been on the road or somewhere near, but it wasn't everywhere. Because I remember when when they installed the electric lining, it was done so one night after work, because first you work, then you keep on working. The Italian community got together, and I remember them, you know, at night, lifting this gigantic wooden pole from the back of a lorry and dumping it into a hole. That was the pole that they were going to connect the wire, the electrical wires to.
So they did it themselves?
Oh, yeah.
And inside...
Not connecting the wires, for heaven's sake, but pulling the pole in, yes.
Seems unusual, you know, for today. In that house or that shed...
it was a house.
It was a house.
So because my mum and dad, you know, everyone, they painted it, you know, they decorated it. It was the house. It was a normal house inside.
So if you went in...
Outside they painted the corrugated iron, nice colour, nice... they had the screen for the flies put in, everything. It was nice. Small, but nice.
So what was it like inside if you went in the front door?
Now I can't remember. We had two bedrooms. Kitchen. Two bedrooms and a kitchen and another room, I think. The laundry was at the back. Toilet was at the back.
Bathroom?
At the back, outside.
And was it another decent sized block, like for a garden?
The block was enormous. The block would have been 2,000 metres. I'm not kidding. It was a 1,000 metre block. Maybe it was 1,005. It was a very big block. And the house was at the back. It wasn't at the front.
And how did the land get used in the front?
Garden.
Vegetables?
Vegetables, flowers, trees, you name it. I remember Mum and Dad, they planted rosemary. And you know that rosemary, you can trim it. They made a hedge of rosemary where you came in with your car. It was very nice.
So your parents bought a car?
My father bought a Hillman, Minx, afterwards.
Second hand?
Third, fourth hand. I'll show you Rikito's car, the first car Rikito bought.
So when you moved in there, the next house wasn't ready yet?
When we moved in, I can't remember, you know, to be precise, but I think it was ready soon after. And the house next to us was Piero Mattiasso's. But it was, you know, more or less together, I think. But...
And how long did your family stay there at Glen Eagles?
I think about 5 years, 6 years.
And what was the next move?
The next move, Mum and Dad, well, you know, work, there was plenty of work they were doing. My father used to do a lot of shifts. So did he, everyone did. He bought a block of land on Frobisher Avenue, off Grange Road. That's so you, where Crittenden Road and Grange Road intersect, going looking at the city, right? On the right, you've got Frobisher Avenue in Flinders Park. So he bought this old, utterly devastated house in Flinders Park. When I say devastated, it was ruined. It was a mess. It was a shambles. It hadn't been looked after. It was in shocking condition. I remember the house. It was a nice house. It was a big house, nice block. But the owners used to live in it, and as a kid, I was shocked to see the filth inside. Because I remember the bathtub was black. You know, it was full of. They used to wash their cutlery there in the bathtub. I'm not kidding. And but they were nice people, you know. They used to have German shepherds, and the German shepherds would be in the house, and they'd have their claw marks on the doors. And they used to have a stable, a very, very small. They were into horses, I don't know for what. They used to have a farm out of Adelaide too. This wasn't them. I don't know if they used to live there, but they had...
Well, we're just going to pause this for a moment.
Yes. Avanti. What's the time?
We've done an hour.
Really?
Mm.
Good morning.